There we go. Good afternoon. I call this meeting of the Human Services Policy Committee meeting to order. Members, please take your seat. We do have a quorum present. Our first item on the agenda is approval of the minutes from Wednesday, March 20th. Chair, Vice Chair Frederick, would you like to move the minutes?
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Representative Frederick moves the minutes for March 20th, 2024. Any questions or amendments? Hearing none, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed say nay. Motion prevails and the minutes are adopted. Members, today we will now be hearing from the Department of Human Services on their legislative memo regarding out-of-state children's residential treatment. Following DHS will be a perspective from the counties and then a list of providers and advocates. If you have questions for any of our testifiers or presenters, we'll have plenty of time for them to be asked. We will be starting off right off the bat with a PowerPoint presentation here with Jennifer Sommerfeld and Christy Grom from the Department of Human Services. Welcome to the committee. If you folks would like to introduce yourselves, and then we please begin the presentation.
Certainly. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Jennifer Sommerfeld. I'm with Children and Family Services at the Department of Human Services.
Sorry, Mr. Chair. Christy Grom with the Department of Human Services. I cover behavioral health and a few other parts of the department.
Very good. And which of you will be starting first? Ms. Sommerfeld, go ahead, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. So today's presentation is going to cover four items. I'm going to start the presentation off with children's out-of-state residential treatment data. Christy Grom here is going to provide an overview and update on children's mental health system. And then, as the chair noted, the counties and mental health providers will also step in and provide some information for you and perspective as well. So today I'm starting off the presentation with some information on the data the agency shared with the legislature in the memo that the chair referenced regarding the number of children placed in children's residential facilities in other states and the total cost for that care. As a reference, this slide four, simply provides the session law for you to look at. I'm not going to walk through it, but if you need to review it, it is here for your reading. So I'll start off before I get into the data, noting that gathering it was challenging. The Social Services Information System, or SSIS, is used for documenting, by local agencies, for documenting placement information, issuing payments, reporting payment activities to the state. It's not a system that is designed to gather summary data, as was requested by the session law. Relying on SSIS payment data is complicated, not just because SSIS is antiquated, which you may have heard in other discussions, but also because SSIS payment data does not break down costs by payment source. That occurs outside of SSIS through separate county fiscal reporting to the state. The fiscal reporting that's outside of SSIS, unfortunately, wasn't a good fit either because it doesn't distinguish between placement locations, so we wouldn't be able to get at the data that way. So ultimately, we determined that the only option we really had was to use SSIS payment data because it would most closely connect fiscal and placement information together. To ensure that we had consistency across counties, DHS pulled all the data from SSIS and sent a validation survey to counties. And we learned a lot during the validation survey. It enlightened us quite a bit on how counties record data and that there are some differences in how that work is done. Making sure I'm on the right slide. So the data we pulled from SSIS is contained in relevant budgeting, reporting, and accounting for social services codes, also known as BRAS codes. BRAS codes are used in SSIS to track local social service activities on a case and for completing quarterly reports. Each BRAS code will designate a specific service provided rather than characteristics of clients or the funding source. So, for example, a county could report having paid for adolescent life skills training using BRAS 146 or for issuing a child family foster care payment via BRAS 181. Unfortunately, there is not a specific BRAS code for children's residential facilities. So we determined that the closest code that we could use would be BRAS 483, which is for children's residential treatment. In addition to looking at the BRAS codes, data was sorted using other parameters such as the state fiscal year, total cost, county and federal contributions. To get a placement out of Minnesota, we applied a parameter for children's residential facilities located in another state To do this, the data was sorted based on the physical home, billing or mailing address of the facility if it's located outside of Minnesota. So I'll note that this means that there could be some inaccuracies in the data because some children may be in Minnesota facilities that have parent companies that are billed outside of Minnesota. So that's one of the problems that we have with being able to isolate the data that we needed for this report. So we pulled the data from for the years we needed through October of 2023 using the parameters I mentioned. We entered it into a survey through Qualtrics and sent it to each county or county consortium director with instructions for them to review it and make corrections as needed. And then we spent a lot of time working with county staff to resolve data issues and questions that they had about the data. One thing that did come back was that counties enter some information under different brass codes based on their billing practices. So we ended up having to add a couple of additional codes to the data that we pulled. So we went back and did that, and it related to children's group residential care and corrections. Unfortunately, when we pulled that data, there wasn't time for us to go back and validate it, so we are just relying for those two types of placements on data in SSIS. So just a couple of quick caveats. You'll see some of these in the report. DHS worked closely with county staff, as I mentioned, to ensure that we were getting consistent and reliable data to the extent possible. But we do know, as I mentioned, that this maybe isn't exactly accurate to all the data that's in our system due to the system limitations. I want to talk a little bit about county billing and data entry practices. They can vary across the state for a few reasons. So first of all, DHS provides guidance on brass codes, but local interpretations of our guidance might vary. Additionally, billable services might not fit exactly into a brass code, so counties will have to make the best decision that they can about where to enter that information into the system. And then at times there might be system errors in SSIS itself, resulting in the need to use a different brass code. So with all those limitations noted, you should consider the data that we're providing to be a bit of a close estimate, we believe. So I'll start going through the data. Children's group residential care, which is on pages 4 and 5 of the memo that you received, this data was pulled by DHS and not sent to counties for validation. You'll see that for fiscal years 2018 through 2022, there were a total of 182 unique children, or an average of 36 per state fiscal year, who were placed in out-of-state facilities in group children's group residential care, and this is our BRAS 186, one of the ones we added. Total county costs for this care during this period were approximately $18.4 million, or about $3.66 million per state fiscal year. And then total federal Title IV-E reimbursements for these placements were approximately $917,000, or about $183,000 per year. There were 20 counties or county consortia with children in out-of-state placements in this in group residential care during that time frame. And then of those, three had at least one child in the placement setting each of the fiscal years that were covered. Moving on to correctional facilities, this data is on page 6 of the memo you received. Like the previous slide, this data was pulled by DHS and not sent to counties for validation. For state fiscal years 2018 through 2022, a total of 59 unique children, or an average of 12 per state fiscal year, were placed in out-of-state correctional facilities. Note that the average is a little bit skewed because for two of the fiscal years, there was just one child in placement. So if you want to look at a more representative average for state fiscal years 2018 to 2020, the average was about 28 unique children per state fiscal year. The total cost for this care were about $2.4 million, or about $478,000 per state fiscal year. And then the total 4E reimbursements were approximately $209,000, or about $42,000 per year. And there were 10 counties or county consortia that had children in placement in these facilities during that time frame, and none of them had a child in placement each of those years. And then finally, for my part of the presentation, children's residential treatment, and this was the initial brass code that we sent out for validation. The data is found on pages 7 through 12 of the report. Except for statewide totals, this data was all verified and corrected as needed by county agency staff from 67 county or county consortia, and that was out of 72 counties or county consortia. Five counties did not respond to the survey, so we included data pulled from two of them, Kitson and Winona, in the report, but have indicated their data was not verified. I'll add, though, that when we sent the survey to counties, we told them that if the data was accurate, they did not need to respond to the survey. So our assumption is they validated that data. Three other counties were not did not respond: Carlton, Cook, and Itasca. And they did not respond because they don't have any data in SSIS entered for this brass code during that time frame. So they were excluded from the report for that reason. 43 counties or county consortia had children in a placement in children's residential treatment during this time frame. Of those, 13 counties or county consortia had at least one child in placement for each of the fiscal years in the time frame. There are several other caveats in the report related to this data, but ultimately, it indicates that for state fiscal years 2018 through 2022, a total of 227 children, or about 45 for state fiscal year, were in out-of-state children's placement. And I encourage you to read in the memo what some of the caveats are through all the data. Total county costs for care during that period was approximately $22 million, or about $4.32 million per state fiscal year, and the reimbursements for federal Title IV E, were approximately $2.03 million, or about $405,000 per year. And that completes my part of the presentation. If you have questions, please let me know.
Okay. We'll probably go to, first of all, have Director Grom go, and then we'll come back and we'll do questions for both of you. Director Grom, if you'd like to go ahead.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Christy Grom with the Department of Human Services. And so I'm just going to walk through a few slides. They're probably mostly background for members, but we just wanted to provide a little bit of context about the mental health system under Medicaid specifically as a whole, and then talk a little bit about some of the challenges, opportunities, and some of the specific residential services that are a part of our continuum. So moving to, I'll try to say the slide so you can all follow along in your packets. Moving to slide 14. So really just wanted to start with a grounding of what our current continuum of MA services are. And so you'll see on the continuum in front of you, all of our MA children's mental health services, or most of them. And they're sort of ranging from low acuity non-residential services on the left end of the continuum, and then moving to the right end, you're looking at more intense, more residential services, and then in between, some gray area there. So kind of starting at the first level on the left, outpatient psychotherapy, school-based services, those are really important services, early intervention services, to make sure that we're connecting with children and youth early on and getting them the services they need. Sort of related but a little bit different is CTSS, which you hear probably referred to a lot in this committee. It's Children's Therapeutic Services and Supports. So this is a service that serves people with kids with emotional disorders, and really helps to bring the child and the family into a healing place, improve their functioning in the community. So it's providing services like psychotherapy, skills training, crisis training. It's sort of a suite of medical assistance services. Related to CTSS is EIDBI, Early Intensive and Developmental Behavioral Interventions. So this is our autism benefit that is for people with autism spectrum disorder and related conditions. And so again, serving kids under 21, there are six different modalities that are offered under this kind of treatment. And it's certainly related to CTSS, but a little bit different, a little bit more nuanced. We've got our mobile crisis services, meeting children where they're at in the community when they're experiencing a crisis, connecting them to outpatient services, connecting them to acute care services and their families as needed. Day treatment services, these are provided typically as another service under CTSS. So those are a little bit higher intensity where kids are in a structured site-based environment getting services. To sort of stabilize their mental health conditions, improve their socialization skills, make sure that they're doing well, that they're thriving in community. CIBS, Children's Intensive Behavioral Health Services, this used to be called ITFC, Intensive Treatment and Foster Care. We changed that name because a couple of years ago the legislature expanded the definition, which was wonderful. So it used to just be available for kids who were in foster care settings or in out-of-home placements. And now this is a service that's available to kids under 21 who are in those foster care settings or out-of-home placement, but also who might be at risk for ending up needing a higher level of care and ending up in residential treatment. So this is another sort of team-based suite of services. There's psychoeducation, psychotherapy, clinical consultation, individual treatment plan, and a really sort of intensive mental health services that's provided at least 3 days a week to kids. We've got ERMS, which used to be called Youth Act. So this is another team-based service for kids that are experiencing some pretty significant mental health issues. And then as we move a little bit closer to sort of the higher acuity services, wanted to make mention of some of the services we have in place that you might think of them as kind of traditionally on the disability continuum of care, but they're oftentimes serving children that are having co-occurring disability or mental health conditions. So things like 245D or home and community-based services under the waivers that are provided in a person's own home. Community residential services under the waivers, people sometimes call those group homes, family residential services, and then MYTH, which is a program that direct care and treatment operates in a sort of a specialized family foster care setting for kids who have particularly high needs. And then lastly, sort of rounding out this continuum, we've got, of course, our psychiatric residential treatment facilities, which we'll focus a lot on today, hospitals, our CABS program, and children's residential facilities. So moving to slide 15, talking a little bit about some of the landscape, the lay of the land in terms of the mental health system. And so wanted to talk a little bit about prevalence, talk a little bit about opportunities that we have in this system and sort of kind of where we're at, where we might need to go, talk a little bit about workforce and complex transitions before getting into the residential services themselves, just so you can kind of get a sense of what we're up against and what we're working with at the moment as we partner with all of you to improve this system. So on slide 15, you'll see a lot of data from the Minnesota Student Survey. The most recent Minnesota Student Survey was in 2022. This is a survey that I believe is administered by the Department of Education. And I think with support from DHS and Department of Health as well. It surveys students in grades 5, 8, 9, and 11. Schools can add other grades as well. The last survey surveyed about 135,000 students. And so it's a good snapshot. It's a good way for us to get data as a state to understand what kids are going through on a variety of different issues. So today we're focusing on mental health, but there's, you know, the survey also talks a lot about bullying and how kids are doing in terms of exposure to, you know, substance use disorder or other issues that are facing our young adults today. And so as you can see, in 2022 really had a historic result in terms of what that survey was saying about students' mental health, and historic in you know, probably all the wrong ways. We've seen an increase in mental health severity and prevalence for kids prior to the pandemic, and certainly we've seen with the 2022 data that that's just gotten worse. So we've got 29% of students that are now reporting long-term mental health problems compared to about 23% in 2019 and 18% in 2016. So seeing increases in these numbers, really alarming, serious suicidal thoughts jumping up to 28% in 2022 compared to 23% in 2013. And so you can take a look at some of this data. I won't read it all to you, but one thing I do want to note is that students that were reporting mental distress, that tended to be a lot more severe and significant for certain populations. And those really, the populations that really stood out are LGBTQI+, as well as students that were facing housing insecurity, and then also really significant changes for female students as well. And the next slide, slide 15, really just breaks down that data a little bit more granularly, so you can take a look at that. Sorry, it's not a great picture on the graph, but hopefully it's kind of small. Hopefully you can read it, and if you've got questions, we're happy to talk more about that. But here again, you can see data broken down by race. You can see American Indian children, Native children are most prominently affected by some of the mental health issues that we're seeing kids face in schools today, as well as other Black and Brown populations. And then did just want to call out in the housing status category, you can see that emotional distress is higher when someone is in, you know, insecure housing compared to in stable housing. But look at how that number jumps from 60% to 78% when a child is housing insecure without an adult or without a parent. So meaning that they're in foster care or in out-of-home placement. So I think that's really important information for the context of what we're talking about today. Mental health workforce, certainly an issue. We've talked about that a lot for this session and many previous sessions, so I won't go too much into it. But of course, we have an aging workforce. We have a workforce where workers, especially in the healthcare field, are burned out. They are leaving prematurely in this profession. We've seen in some cases in mental health fields, the pre-pandemic numbers of vacancy rates are still not kind of bouncing back to where we would expect them to be in this field. And so lots of challenges on the workforce end. Certainly we'll talk about that when we talk a little bit about the residential services and really what they're experiencing in terms of getting staffed up and at full capacity to serve the community. Moving on to the next slide. And this one thing I did want to, I should mention before we move to the slide, is just the workforce for Black, Indigenous, people of color is particularly lacking. And when you look at our student survey results and you see those disparities, we really do need to do better as a state. And I know there are multiple partners here today that are going to talk that are engaged in this work. The state also should be playing an important role, as should the legislature, in trying to figure out how we can better recruit and retain Black, Indigenous, people of color providers so that we can get those really positive outcomes that we know are more possible when students identify with their provider in that way. So then moving to slide 18, building a comprehensive system. You've heard a lot this session about building blocks and why it's important to build a really good foundation in our mental health system. And I think you've heard advocates probably talk over the years that we really haven't built our system yet. We're in process. And we've done a lot of good work in partnership with the legislature, but there is some work to do. And so I wanted to just use this slide just to make mention of a couple opportunities that we have in the future, maybe more than a couple. It's maybe an ambitious list, but I think, you know, things that we should be talking about with community, certainly. So I first wanted to mention that here we're mostly focused on residential services. And of course, that is a critical aspect. When kids need those emergency services, we have to be there as a state, as a society, to meet them where they're at and help them get well. And we also have to be there earlier on, and we have to identify those issues when they occur in school. They might not be as noticeable. We need to be working, for example, with our preventative care, our primary care physicians, to make sure they're integrating mental health, where it's easier for parents to access those services and identify them when children are younger. And so I just want to give a shout out here. I know we've talked about this session, but our MA fee-for-service outpatient rates are sorely lacking, and a huge reason why we're seeing, I think, maybe I don't have the causal connection exactly, but we're seeing extraordinary wait lists at outpatient programs. And when those wait lists go as long as they are, like I'm talking 4+ weeks, and the providers can talk more about that today, we should expect to see kids' mental health worsening as a state. And so that's something that I think we all agree as a community that we need to address. And then I did just want to mention, you know, I showed in the beginning that continuum of services, the current MA services, that's sort of more or less what we have today, and it's a really good start. But there's a list of services here I just wanted to touch on briefly with all of you that, you know, we've been talking about with community for a while, and that we should probably think about kind of cementing into our MA bedrock, our foundation of services, to really make sure that it's strong, really make sure that it's responsive and agile to meet all of the different needs that we're seeing across the state. So one of the services we've been talking with community about is children's residential crisis services. We don't have a medical assistance model for this right now. We have some flexibilities with children's residential facilities that occurred a couple of years ago, where we're trying to use beds in those settings for 30-day or less stays for kids that are in crisis. And we've been working as a department with the community and identifying what could this benefit look like, what would some of the parameters be, who would we serve. And so we would really love to work with community further on this and actually develop a medical assistance model and hopefully come back to the legislature and get some funding for that to implement it. Another thing we've been talking about with community and kind of internally in the department is children's mental health residential step down services. So I mentioned on that continuum, we've got, you know, 245D group homes, we've got in-home services, we have on the, more on the disability side, we have some of those step down services, but they might not always be the right setting for a child with mental health issues. So one thing that we might think about is looking at a setting something like an IRTS, intensive residential treatment services, which is allowable for adults for children. So something under the state plan that is maybe less than 16 beds for kids that are having, you know, serious mental health issues, another step down option to really catch them, meet them where they're at in that moment when they're releasing from a hospital or from another setting, and get them stable so that they can then transition back to their family homes. Juvenile reentry services, this is something we've talked about with Chair Knorr and the governor's proposal and others who are bringing forward proposals to provide services to adults and children prior to release from corrections. So that's a really important thing that we can add to our system to support families, support children. Violence prevention, this is something that Hennepin Healthcare and other hospitals have been coordinating on for quite a while. They've got a grant-funded program right now, but we do have some examples of other states being able to get this approved under our state plan. And certainly we think this would be a really huge help to support youth in our state right now. Collaborative care, we've talked about that in this committee before, as well as there are now options for payment for certain coordinated care services, coordinated specialty care under first episode psychosis to pay for that under Medicaid. And so that's something that we could, you know, we have opportunities to build up our system more with. And then moving to slide 19, talking a little bit about the phenomena that you've all heard about a lot this session and in previous years is just people who have complex conditions. So people who are oftentimes struggling with mental health and behavioral and disability issues all at the same time. And so just wanted to note that this is a really, really important issue for adults and kids, but focusing mostly on kids today. So this slide 19 just kind of shows what we're seeing in terms of who is getting stuck right now. And so you can see for children under 20, primarily kids that are involved in child protection system, a lot of native overrepresentation in this kind of bucket, kids that are have autism or related conditions. And then for both children and adults, you can see that what we're seeing is that these are individuals kind of getting stuck in hospitals, not having the right level of care, that are oftentimes having labeled aggressive behaviors. They've got significant trauma histories, or oftentimes you have a different communication style. They're nonverbal a lot, so that makes it challenging to work with staff. And then, of course, that complex dual diagnosis that I mentioned earlier. And then moving to slide 20. This is just some initial data that we've got from our work at the department. We've really put a lot of effort into addressing complex care transitions, working with our hospital partners and others. Over the past couple of years, we've got an advisory council as well that is going on this. So hopefully that's generating some ideas in addition to those ideas that are being discussed here at the legislature. But some of the initial data that we got back on why people are getting stuck is what we're talking about here today. We don't have enough units. We don't have enough staff. We're kind of those specialized, individualized needs, whether that be at the PRTF level or even an in-home setting. Sometimes the appropriate or therapeutic level of care just doesn't exist in Minnesota. Sometimes someone has such an individualized need, and we just don't have that option in Minnesota. We've heard a lot from the community about, hospitals have a very important focus on addressing acute care needs, but they don't necessarily have that background or the capacity to provide positive support services. So services that are gonna help reduce those behaviors that are maybe aggressive. So instead of using restraints, seclusion, sometimes chemical restraints or these are services that can better create better outcomes for children. And so that's something that when they're not provided, we're seeing worse outcomes for kids and kind of getting stuck because they're getting labeled as aggressive, but they're just not getting the right service. And we'll hear from counties and others a little bit more about that today. And then caregiver training, that's mostly related to individuals are going to maybe a group home setting and that group home doesn't have the right training for that specific person. They don't have person-centered care plans. They don't truly understand sort of what that person's triggers are. Sometimes it is a really simple, subtle thing or things, group of things to help support an individual. But if you don't really know who that child is that's coming into your doors, there could be triggers that don't create good outcomes for them. So then moving into the portion of the presentation that just talking a little bit about some of our particular residential settings. The first one is MITH, Minnesota Intensive Therapeutic Homes. So this is a state operated service. It's really kind of a unique family foster care setting for youth who have pretty severe mental health conditions and behavioral health support needs. So this is something that direct care and treatment contracts with providers who are already licensed family residential services providers, and they provide these services to children 24 hours a day. They essentially become DHS employees, is my understanding of sort of operationally how this works. And each child gets coordinated wraparound services. There's treatment teams that meet regularly that include the foster parents, the family members, clinical support from that particular program, social workers, school staff, et cetera. And then kids are still maintaining their community connections. They're in school, and that particular family is getting a lot of support from RNs and other clinical staff to make sure their needs are met. And then moving to slide 22, children's residential facilities. So children's residential facilities provide treatment to kids in a group setting. So there's services that kind of range, different kinds of services are provided, but obviously supervision, food, lodging, and then training, education, and then sometimes treatment services. So we've got about, I believe, 16 mental health children's residential facilities in Minnesota, and they have the capacity to serve about 700 kids. Total for all of the CRF facilities, we've got about 95 facilities and 2,200 kids being served. And so, as you'll see on the slide, these are programs that can either be licensed by DHS or the Department of Corrections, and they range in different, they're certified in different areas of specialty. So for DOC, they're really focused on sort of correctional and secure programs, and at DHS, we support shelter programs, transitional housing programs, and mental health and SUD programs where kids live in these settings. So these are primarily institutional settings. They're not all of them, but I think most of them. And they're a little bit of a larger setting and have a range of services that are provided. And then moving to psychiatric residential treatment facilities, or PRTFs. We've talked a lot about these, so I won't dwell on them too much, but this is essentially a hospital level of care. A kind of specialty psychiatric hospital level of care for kids under 21 who've got very severe mental health conditions. Eligibility is based on medical necessity, whereas some programs like children's residential facilities that I mentioned before, sometimes kids end up in those settings due to a placement, although there is an option for them to not have to go through that child protection pathway. But PRTFs are based on medical necessity alone, and so hopefully more accessible to the community in that sense. And just to note that we've worked over the years identifying the increasing severity of mental health issues and really have worked with the provider community to make sure that there are, in addition to Medicaid reimbursement, these are reimbursed under a cost-based rate methodology that's specific to the provider. So they submit cost reports, but they've also got, we have grant funding that we can use to support these settings to specialize in serving kids with really complex needs. So neurocognitive disorders, schizophrenia disorders, labeled aggressive. We want to make sure that if there are increased costs to serve those populations, that we're supporting them as much as we can. Moving to slide 24, this just kind of shows a snapshot of where we're at. Some of these numbers are a little bit outdated on your slide. They're from a couple months ago, so a little bit outdated, but pretty close. So we've got about 300 total beds that are funded for psychiatric residential treatment facilities in Minnesota. And we've got, you can see on the map, we have five locations. One of them is not open, so we've got four operating facilities. Throughout the state, you can see on the western part of the state, not much going on there. But we are sort of building out that model. This is something that was passed by the 2015 legislature, so it's a newer service to our system. And what we're seeing is the primary issue with providers getting to use all of their beds is staffing. And so they're really having trouble finding the nursing staff, finding the clinical staff, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week to support all of the kids that they want to in these settings. So that's why you're seeing that the utilized beds are a little bit lower than what the licensed beds actually are. And then moving to slide 25, our child and adolescent behavioral health hospital, CABS. So this is a hospital that is in Willmar. So it's an inpatient psychiatric hospital for kids between 4 and 18. And so it's a psychiatric hospital, a little bit different than other hospitals in this state. It's usually accepting children who have exceptionally complex mental health and behavioral disorders who really have not been able so far, they have not responded to treatment in their own homes and communities. So many of these children have multiple diagnoses that range from brain and behavior disorders to psychiatric, PTSD, and for most of the kids in these settings, other treatments have yet to be effective. So this is sort of at the high end of our continuum, the place where we can provide the highest level of care in Minnesota right now. We've got, I believe, about 8 beds that are funded at this particular hospital right now, and we've got a proposal in the governor's budget to double that, hopefully to increase some capacity there. And so that's what I had for a snapshot of the system. Happy to answer any questions, or we can just hear from our partners at the counties and provider community.
Okay, thank you. I know that there are going to be some questions here as I'm looking around. I'm not seeing, I do have a couple of questions. I just want to give others the chance if they want to go first. Not seeing them? Okay, I will start off. Yeah. Oh, excuse me. I see the hands up. That's all right. Representative Keel, are you first?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Christy, can you tell me, is there any North Dakota facilities that we're using? It seems to me, I thought there was one in Fargo or Grand Forks for youth, but maybe that's not the case. And is that more complicated than sending a child to Wilmer? How does that work? Seems to me I learned something about it, but would you fill that in, please?
Director Graham.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'm not really familiar with the facilities in North Dakota, but I have heard in conversations with our staff who work on complex care transitions, who work on mental health, that I believe I have heard that there are children that receive services out of state. I'm not sure if Ms. Sommerfeld might know better than I with her data. But essentially where a child goes, or it really depends on what their needs are. And so we get lots of constituent requests, as you know, and we hear about really sometimes very unique needs. And so in my role, we sort of dig into those, and it's my understanding that it's really contingent on what the needs are of the individual in terms of where they go. I'm not sure the level of severity that is served in North Dakota or the facility or facilities that you're referring to versus our CAB facility.
Okay, Representative Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, I'd like to publicly apologize. Director Graham is your name, and I apologize for that. And I appreciate that. As you can see on that map, for everybody that's looking, if we're talking about somebody coming in from the northwest portion of Minnesota, and I'm talking maybe north of even my district, which is 2 more hours in Minnesota, Wilmer alone is 4 hours from my house. So I know that's not simple, and how do we do those things? And of course we don't have the management facilities to manage the facility, much less the services. But I just want to point out how difficult that is for families and how distant that is. It is hard to transport a child that is already unstable and family that might have to have that access or ability. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Keel. Next I have Representative Backer.
Thank you, Chair. And just a little quick ditto on what Representative Keel, I mean, I'm closer to Wilmer, our constituents, than Representative Keel, but still, as we know, a lot of those individuals have challenges of getting from point A to point B, just don't have the resources. So my question is this, as we can see a significant gap, what we're consistently hearing is about the lack of group home level of care for children who require ongoing support to achieve treatment and stability needs. We know that. So how are you intending to support development of this part of our continuum?
Director Graham.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I think, you know, a lot of the work that we've been doing right now through the, we've stood up a whole new division, essentially, a whole new part of the department that deals with complex care transitions. And a lot of that work really is centered around educating and recruiting providers who are interested to serve these individuals that have higher needs. And so we are certainly building capacity in that sense. We've had a few different events. I wish I had the statistics with me today, but we've had over the past few months, we've had events where we're actually inviting providers in saying, you know, is this a match for you? There's an individual has these needs, they're stuck at this facility, and here's all of the things that are great about them. Here's their kind of person-centered, who they are, the wonderful things about them. Here's their triggers. Really trying to connect people with providers in a very intentional way. And so I think that's a big part of what we're doing. In terms of children's residential facilities, and because when you say group homes, that means a lot of different things. But in terms of 245D, like community residential services, group homes, and children's residential facilities, I don't believe that we can, I believe there's moratoriums in place for both of those services because we're trying to get away from institutional-like care. But there's certainly capacity here and there so that we've got exceptions to the moratorium, for example, when people need to go to settings because they're stuck or because they have some really exceptional needs. So those are some of the ways that we've been doing that work. I think on the slide where I mentioned different MA services, talks about kind of like building a comprehensive system. Those are, for many of those services that are listed as something that we could think about as a state and adding to our continuum. Those are some of them things that we've been having conversations about. Some of them are actually in the governor's budget. I mentioned that the CAB hospital is increasing its capacity in the governor's supplemental budget recommendations this year. So I think there's a lot of work that we're doing sort of administratively and with the community to get ready. And then there's a lot of concrete proposals that we can point to in the budget as well.
Representative Becker.
Yeah, thank you. My follow-up would be is how many do you believe of the children are we still missing? You talked about adding more capacity. It would be nice offline if you could share with what type of capacity has been added. But how many from your gut are you thinking are still falling through the cracks that need that type of support?
Director Grau.
Mr. Chair, Representative Becker, I don't know that we can quantify that. I can certainly go back and reach out to my colleagues and see what we can pull together. I think Ms. Sommerfeld, you know, her area did a whole analysis, and it's very challenging to pull together all of that data into one data set that aligns and doesn't sort of conflict with each other. But I would say that one thing just to note is that the issue, in particular for kids that have complex and really high acute support needs, that is an issue that we've had, that we've lived with for a long time. It's not really a new issue. We're seeing some of those needs, you know, get more severe. We're seeing more of them, but a lot of that probably has to do with earlier intervention, which is a good thing. So this is a problem that the system has grappled with for a while and really needs to figure out and to, and sometimes acknowledge that there are situations where those children, their needs might get exacerbated for a period of time. We just have to make sure that our system is agile and so that when their needs increase, they can get to the right setting at the right time, they can get things maintained, they can get their symptoms under control, and then transition back to other parts of the support system, whether that's their family home or lower level of care. So I don't have those exact numbers. We can certainly look offline and see what we might be able to provide to you in terms of in the Medicaid system, what we might project.
Okay. Representative Becker.
That's good. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Very good. Representative Frederick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think this would be more to Director Sommerfeld, but when it comes to legislative policymaking, we like to base our decisions on data and not just how we're feeling in the moment. It was clear in the initial part of the presentation that kids getting placed out of state is not necessarily a piece of data that we are tracking as a state. So instead of diving into the weeds right away, I guess I'm going to ask more of that 30,000 foot view. Do you think that data is something that DHS should be doing a better job of tracking and then using that to inform its advocacy and decision making?
Director Sommerfeld.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Frederick, well, I guess this isn't a department position, but yes, we should be doing a better job of tracking data throughout our system. But we've had discussions about this in other committees. SSIS is an antiquated system. It doesn't track data the way that we want to nowadays. We're looking for more things. We have more complicated cases. So in order to do that, I think we need to work toward modernization of SSIS. And as we build out a new system, we will be putting in, our intention would be to be putting in far better data tracking that would make it easier for us to pull this information out. For example, the part about us having to look at the address of where the billing occurred and the limitation of the fact that that might actually be picking up kids who are placed in Minnesota. We would hope that we would, in a new system, have an easier way to track that. That would be easier to pull out.
Vice Chair Frederick.
So I have another question then about when we're talking about the spectrum of services that we provide, one is much less intense, and then we saw on the other end of the spectrum is much more intense, dealing with much more complex, challenging, aggressive, potentially behavioral issues that we're dealing with. And we talk about a lack of staffing in those spaces as well. quite often when we have these conversations, a lot of it goes back to discussions about reimbursement rates and money. I don't think that that's the whole picture. I don't think that's the whole solution. So my question then is, what is DHS or any branch within DHS, so this isn't your, I mean, whoever wants to answer it can, outside of simply looking at reimbursement rates, outside of money, what is DHS advocating for in those spaces in regards to training of staff, looking at what tools are available, looking at the mental health of the staff that are working in those situations. Last year we heard testimony from people who came to the committee talking about how they were physically assaulted as simply a caregiver. And so we need to look at the overall health of the staff as well. And so I'm just curious what advocacy the department is bringing forward that's outside of just a fiscal approach.
Who would like to try to tackle it? Director Graham.
Mr. Chair, Representative Frederick, so certainly this year we've been constrained a bit by the budget. So I think it's right of you to think about and be wondering and pushing for us to be more creative about what we're doing. You know, we certainly have some policy bills we brought forward this year. We've tried to reflect the provider community's wishes in some of those bills. So for example, we've had requirements that just make things a little easier for providers that do, you know, community residential services, do DWS services in terms of how they document and submit forms. We've had a bill related to behavioral health home to make sure that that the staff in those settings are able to initiate and authorize services more easily for a client so that they can do that maybe electronically instead of having to meet with that person who is often jumping through a lot of hoops, having some, you know, really chronic health conditions. So those are a couple of kind of policy examples I can think of off the top of my head. Certainly, I mean, we can send you more information, but we would love to partner with you on what some of your ideas are. And we certainly have partnered with the legislature this session and know that a lot of those provider ideas in terms of flexibilities are moving forward.
Representative Hicks.
Thank you, both of you, for bringing this report. As you know, this is an issue that is really near and dear to my heart. But I did have a couple of clarifying questions. Ms. Graham, on slide 22, you talked about the children's residential facilities, and you said 16 mental health facilities serving 700 kids, and then you said 2,200 kids overall in all the different facilities. So does that mean that 1,500 of those kids are in corrections?
Mr.
Director Graham.
Representative Hicks, I can certainly double check the data and get it to you. I have a spreadsheet that I could email to you, but I just got this data this morning, so we can certainly clarify that for you if I said something wrong or got crunched those numbers wrong.
Representative Hicks.
Yeah, I have no idea if they're right or wrong. If twice as many of the beds are correction than mental health, I think that's a conversation we should be having out loud about why that is. Mm-hmm. And then the other question was about PRFTs. You had on slide 24 talked to us about the total beds that the legislature funded in 2015, which you know, is almost a decade ago, be a decade and 6 months here. And so we funded 300. We have 158 licensed, we only have 77 operating. So less than a third of what was this body authorized 9.5 years ago are online. And the mental health crisis for children has gotten worse in that 10 years. And so we can talk about all the solutions in the world, but just kind of common sense says if 10 years ago we thought we needed 300, we only have 77, and the mental health crisis has gotten worse, there seems to be a fundamental math problem in how many beds we have online. And so I'm excited to hear from the providers about what that could look like and what they see as their concerns. But also, I know we talked about staffing, but does the department have any other reason why it's taken so long to get those online? And then also the 90 beds left to be allocated via RFP. Could you update us on where that is?
Director Graham.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hicks, certainly we wish that we could be at full census, that providers could be at full census as well. And they really just have reported that they largely cannot do that because they cannot find the staff to keep the children there safe. It is not, there is no easy answer there. So that's what we have overwhelmingly heard from the provider community. When we issue an RFP, we just issued an RFP, I think, in the beginning of February, this past February, if I'm not mistaken. I can double check the dates for you. And we solicit, we do that, I think, at least once a year, if not more. We are looking for providers. We are trying to get providers to come online. And sometimes even when we do, and you know, work with a provider who is interested, at the end of the day, what we hear sometimes is they may not be able to staff. And so we have a situation even with the provider right now that we have contracted that is not in operation, where they are really struggling to find the staff to even open. We were hoping they could open this spring, but those are the staff. It's just a staffing issue that we've been told they're facing.
Representative Hicks.
I don't know if anybody from DCT is here, but why is this not a space that DCT is stepping into?
Director Graham, do you have any, or is anyone from direct care and treatment here?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hicks, I mean, I think we can certainly take that back. That's sort of a question that maybe we would even have the commissioner answer. It seems like kind of a high-level agency decision, and so we can certainly follow up with you, Representative Hicks.
And Director Graham, I'd also be interested in knowing the answers on that, because part of it comes down to, if we're sending kids out of state, one of my questions is how many of those kids we're sending out of state could have been addressed if we had the staffing and built out the Department of Direct Care and Treatment. Is also one of the questions that I have, is mm-hmm. is that part of the missing gap here? Because I see no reference to them at all, and they feel like, it feels like they should be part of this equation.
Mr. Chair, yeah, we should have that conversation. We certainly did talk about a couple of their programs in here, and happy to talk with you more about what your ideas are and what you might want to bring forward and how we can support your ideas in that regard.
Okay, thank you. And then Representative Baker.
Thank you. I think everything that I hear Director Graham talking about is basically it's about money, about paying our providers more to get more people in the industry. You know, last year I think we allocated about $99 million for this, DCT services and levels. The next year we did 10% more, $110 million. And again, last year was an incredible opportunity for us to really make an impact, to really make a seismic shift in getting the providers that want to open up PRTFs that can't do it because they don't have enough money and wiggle room to do it because it's too tight. Mm-hmm. Everything we do around here is about money. And it sounds like when you say because of budget constraints, budget issues, it sounds like, you know, when I was here, you know, 10 years ago when I first came here, it was actually a really tight budget. And we actually were looking at cuts in certain areas. We didn't have that for the last 6 years. And again, for a lot of good reasons, we had a lot of money. I feel like we've not made enough of an impact in this area to our most critically mentally sick people, kids and adults. And we're talking about the kids stuff right now. I'm just so disappointed that we didn't do that. But I think what I will learn a lot today is about what do our partners think about this too. So we're going to hear from them in a few minutes, and I know that that's a big part of this. But as we slice and dice the DC&T hierarchy, and how is this going to look going forward? How do we make sure our kids voices are heard and the families about dealing with the most complex issues, I want to make sure that what are our providers saying we need to do more of? Because I never want to hear how we compare private sector fast food operations to folks working in these facilities. But we hear it every day because we haven't made the seismic shift of saying this is very specialized and we need to focus on this stuff with the finite amount of dollars we do have. We need to focus in this area. Not to keep raising taxes, folks, not to keep doing that. Focus in these areas that we all care about. So I'm hoping that our partnerships will be brought to the table, will be, and again, maybe my to my question here, I'll stop rambling. What are we doing about the partnership outlooks and how we can make sure that the partners are part of this, sharing the responsibility, sharing in this? What is that like now, and do you see a change in coming to this, Director, about making sure our partners are really at the table for this going forward?
Director Graham.
Mr. Chair, Representative Baker, I think that's a really important question. I would say we have strong relationship with our partners. Everyone has a different role in the system and an important role. So DHS looks at the system as a whole. We think about public policy. Provider community has a little bit of a different outlook, and as does the advocate community. And so we need to make sure, and we really are doing our best to make sure that we've got all of those people around the table. Some of the ideas that I talked about in this presentation today, we have current, ongoing, just work groups that we do that you won't hear about necessarily from the providers, but we have multiple standing meetings and work groups and topics that we're working on with the provider community. I think, you know, one thing just to say is this presentation, we built it with the provider community in mind, as well as with lead agencies. So this wasn't something that, you know, when we were asked if we would do this presentation, we said what we invited the provider community. And I think we've done that in Chair Fisher's committee over the years and really been intentional about that. But any way that we can improve, we always want to hear that feedback. And so please do let us know what your ideas are as well, because we want to improve. We know that we can't do this alone.
And just closing, right. Mr. Chair, yes. I think again, and I think that you guys do reach out to partners. I'm not suggesting you don't. It can always be better, and every one of us can admit that. But we're changing the way we run DCT now going forward. We are changing the way the leadership will be structured, and I hope that with all your working groups out there and your partnerships and your listening sessions, that you have a very strong group representing this particular part of our state in need. You've got a very strong voice at the board table now that is going to be listening to what these, so let's get them consolidated. I hope they have a very strong voice, because this is a very complex issue that affects a lot of people, and it's going to be the most expensive folks that we care for are right here. So we got to get this part of it right in order for those folks to have a chance. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative. And with that, we'll end questions there. We've got about a half hour left, and we've got a number of folks who are here to talk to us and offer their thoughts and perspectives. The first person I have coming up is Patty Harrelson, Program Manager for Children and Family Social Services. Welcome to the committee. First of all, thanks for taking the time to be here today. We're looking forward to hearing from you. If you'd like to introduce yourself and begin your testimony, please.
Yes, sir. So thank you. My name is Patty Harrelson, and I'm the manager of Child and Family Social Services in Minnesota Prairie County Alliance, and the co-chair of the MACSA Children's Committee. So I would like to thank you, Chair Fisher, and members of the committee for allowing us to talk to you today. So thank you for the opportunity to testify concerning the care and placement of vulnerable youth. Today, I bring what will sound like a particularly complex case, but is growing more and more routine and underscores the pressing need for comprehensive support and reform across programs from child protection, child welfare, and children's mental health. We do our best each day, but we cannot do this alone. I'm going to talk to you about a specific youth that we're currently dealing with that's placed out of state. This youth is an 11-year-old with a myriad of diagnoses, including reactive attachment disorder, spectrum disorder, specific learning disorders, and trauma-related disorders. He's been facing extraordinary challenges since an early age. Born into a tumultuous environment marred by domestic violence, he tragically lost both of his parents. His father was in a debilitating brain injury accident in 2013. This youth was an infant and in the car at the time. He is in a facility and unable to parent him. While his mother succumbed to sepsis from an untreated urinary tract infection in 2019, for which and for unknown reasons he feels responsible. While this does not make sense, it's his perspective. Placed under permanent state guardianship since December 15th of 2021, this youth has endured a staggering 16 placements in just 4 years. These included 8 non-relative homes, 4 relative or kinship placements, all of which asked for him to be removed. 2 hospital stays, 1 residential treatment program, a residential shelter care placement, and finally the out-of-state behavioral health hospital that he currently resides in. Each placement disrupted due to complexities of his condition and the lack of appropriate support systems. Yet, ironically, he needs significant care due to these very complexities. Despite the efforts of dedicated professionals, including 2 prolonged hospital stays totaling 141 days, a suitable long-term placement has yet to be located. The youth's age, coupled with his behavioral and developmental needs, pose significant barriers to finding stable residential placements both within Minnesota and other states. He has been rejected from the Children Adolescent Behavioral Health Hospital, which is supposed to accept youth ages 4 to 18, ironically because he's not yet 12. We have sought 37 placements before moving to an out-of-state provider. Each told us he was too aggressive for their programming, the milieu was not conducive to his placement, and he was too difficult for their services. We have been unable to get a MnChoices assessment completed as he is not presently in the state, and the one we did get before he left the hospital is only valid for 60 days. He has never been in a place long enough to have a completed MnChoices assessment otherwise. We believe he could qualify for services for youth who are developmentally disabled, but that is also a lengthy process, and under current laws, we must wait for his return to Minnesota. Compounding the issue further, the scarcity of suitable placements has forced counties to continue to seek out-of-home options, out-of-state options, resulting in exorbitant costs and continued strain on local levy dollars. In my role as children's co-chair, we continue to have discussions about county needs and the experiences regarding placement challenges. Currently, one county has 4 children's mental health youth placed out of state at a locally funded average monthly cost of $75,961. One of these youth is in a psychiatric residential treatment facility, or PRTF, which would be at no cost to the agency if there were enough of these beds in state, but there are not. Another county has provided information that they encountered a bright 14-year-old girl in need of intensive psychosocial and behavioral support. Her behaviors were rapid, volatile, and dangerous to herself and in turn to others. The behaviors she needed the most support with were her greatest barriers. Over 25 organizations in Minnesota denied their referrals. Most typically stated reasons included the level of care was not appropriate, they were unable to meet the client needs, and a history of aggression. Meanwhile, repeat visits to the emergency room, law enforcement visits to her home, her dangerous self-harming and extreme distress tolerance behaviors became scary, exhausting, taxing, and costly. After an out-of-state search, she was denied from dozens more organizations for the same reasons they heard in Minnesota. Finally, after over 80 program contacts, an intensive residential placement with psychiatric support was located within Missouri. Her parents, social workers, and other family remained over 550 miles away. 3 months in the program came at a total local cost of $95,000 for this youth. This youth also qualified for a PRTF, but was not available in the state. In addition, the social workers and family would have had easier access for her treatment and to assist in that treatment. Not only is this financially unsustainable for counties and their local levies, but it also deprives youth of the proximity to their communities and support networks, exacerbating their feelings of isolation and detachment. In addition, there are federal and state requirements for face-to-face visits. We cannot do these via an online platform, and frankly, we would not want to. COVID has made this process difficult as we were not allowed in most of those facilities. With these youth in their placements at a minimum of monthly, which for all counties means managing the unexpected costs for staff travel and lost time on other cases, adding to their stresses of our workforce. Sadly, most of the youth in our system do not qualify for private insurance, most are on MA, and rates paid by our Medicaid system are inadequate. Many out-of-state placements will not accept Minnesota Medicaid as payment for their services. In fact, a few facilities that we've contacted will no longer accept a youth from this state. This youth that I've been talking about cost Minn Prairie about $17,000 a month. In addition, because rates are not bundled as they are with adults, our local system pays the rates for room and board set by each facility, as well as their medical and mental health costs, which can be significant. I know of one county who has placed a youth, though locally, at a cost of $3,000 per day in a placement designed specifically for him and his needs. He is the only youth in this placement. This daily rate is entirely on the local county levy. It is imperative that we address this crisis with urgency and resolve. We must prioritize the well-being and prospects of youth by investing in robust support systems that will cater to their complex needs. This necessitates a collaborative effort among state agencies, mental health providers, educational institutions, and local communities to develop innovative solutions and ensure access to timely and appropriate care. Furthermore, we must examine the root causes behind the shortage of residential treatments within our state and explore avenues for expanding capacity and enhancing services locally. This includes incentivizing providers to offer specialized care, streamlining assessment processes, and investing in workforce development to meet the growing demand for qualified professionals, while also investing in critical upstream preventative efforts, such as increasing access to economic supports for families and community resource centers. While in this testimony, I have talked about youth with significant needs, our entire system of care needs attention. This is not about child protection, corrections, or the mental health system. It is about building an entire comprehensive system of care that can meet all of the needs of youth, including in-home services, all the way up to residential care. On Thursday, April 4th, the Mental Health Collaborative Hub had 31 youth where medical facilities and residential providers were working together to move these kids from emergency rooms or local hospitals to a placement. You will hear from some of the people who developed this hub shortly. This is an amazing project and very much needed. This system is built on a web-based program that allows good data for these kids. Unfortunately, our child welfare system does not have a reliable data system to monitor information or with which we can review trends, which I know is frustrating to our commissioners, to DHS, and I am sure to this legislative body as well. In my role as a manager, one of my jobs is to support our team, getting them the resources they need to do this difficult work. It is very difficult to do so when I cannot rely on a data system to provide me any type of real, timely, valuable trend data. In conclusion, this case and many others like it serves as a stark reminder to the shortcomings within our system and the urgent need for reform. We owe it to the youth and countless others facing similar challenges to enact meaningful change that prioritizes their well-being, including community supports that empowers them to thrive. Today, I discussed placements for just 6 youth that are out of state at a monthly cost of $124,627, or if it were annual, $1,495,524. Including the in-state specific youth I mentioned, this would require an additional $90,000 per month, or an additional $1,080,000, for a total of $2,575,524. That's just 7 kids, 7. And I know there are more than 7 kids in the state right now that need these kind of services. There is a financial cost to securing these placements, but more importantly, they represent continued and cumulative trauma to these youth. Mm-hmm. We need to do all we can, indeed, all that is in our power, to ensure that youth have access to what they need when they need it, to prevent placement when possible, but when we can't, to find the best, safest placement for them when we can. Gandhi said that the true measure of any society can be found in how it treats its most vulnerable citizens. I hope this can be realized here in Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your testimony. We do have this room only until 2:30, and I have 2, 4, 6, 7 more folks coming up. So
I understand.
I'll have you excused, and then we'll have the next person, Paula Minsky, come up. And if we can keep our comments a little shorter so that we can make sure we can hear from everybody today. Thank you for taking the time to be here. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Paula Minsky, and I'm here today as the board chair of Aspire Minnesota and the vice president of clinical services for Nexus Family Healing. I'm here to speak to the higher view of the direction the Aspire Minnesota provider group feels we need to go. We have a highly complex and underdeveloped continuum. The report invites more questions and does suggest that we can better invest differently to individualize care for children. We have solutions. Serving children who are consistently being failed by our system by needing to be sent out of state, boarding in hospitals, and those that are not being served the care they need right now. That requires building a continuum for the future. It is one that is community-based, family-focused, and individualized to meet our children's unique complexities. Specifically, the future continuum will build on strong current services, develop a full continuum of care. This includes increasing the outpatient Medicaid rates. The future continuum includes the development of meaningful partnerships with the state to jointly invest in the well-being of the children served. The future continuum needs to be creative with individualized service solutions for the unique needs our kids and families have. The future continuum needs to sustain and support the full development of the current licensed capacity in children's residential care. The building of this continuum needs to include respite, crisis residential stabilization, and group home level of care. We also need to expedite quality training and onboarding of staff through a youth care professional training academy. The future continuum also includes the PRTF development. It should focus on the population gaps in care. It is our understanding that DHS has 100 PRTF beds they are still seeking to contract. These beds and these contracts can help address the population gaps that we have. We cannot stress enough the need to start building the future continuum now. Today, we will share provider data, gap analysis, solutions, and future goals for joint continued work. We want our children to have their best lives now and in their future. Thank you for allowing us to share our experiences and our ideas to improve services to meet the complex needs of the children and families we serve. I welcome any questions, but we could also jump into the rest of the providers.
Okay. Thank you. We'll jump into the rest of the providers and to try to make sure we've got enough time for them. I'd like to let folks know as well, time for about 2 minutes each, and that might still give us a chance for a question or two at the very end. Next, I have Mr. Todd Archibald. Welcome to the committee. Thanks for taking the time to be here. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Todd Archibald. I'm a social worker and the CEO of Prairie Care. I'm here to share with you all a success story, a transformation in how we connect some of our most complex youth with treatment. A year and a half ago, our provider community came together to help the increasing number of youth who are in behavioral health crisis, boarding in hospitals, county administration buildings, and even hotels. Emergency departments have become the main point of entry for those in psychiatric crisis, and the time spent boarding has been increasing. Providers were feeling frustrated and adrift by the lack of treatment options and fragmentation throughout our systems. This grassroots effort became known as Getting to Yes. Through our weekly video calls, we developed the Mental Health Collaboration Hub, a secure online portal that matches boarding cases to group homes, therapeutic foster care, residential treatment, crisis stabilization, and more across the entire state. Now there are more than 400 professionals participating, representing more than 185 organizations in Minnesota. The hub has now helped over 250 youth get connected to the care they need, and we have been able to reduce the time spent boarding by 55%. This project has been extraordinary, a demonstration of what a compassionate provider community can do together. While the primary goal of the hub is to connect youth to treatment, a secondary goal is to better understand these complex cases so we can design solutions. We now know that more than 75% have multiple mental health diagnoses. The most common are externalizing disorders, trauma, depression, and autism. The biggest barrier to placement are the complex symptoms or risk factors, with aggression and severe emotional dysregulation present in 85% of all cases. I must stress, each case is unique and requires a unique response. Organizations work hard to find creative solutions to help these kids, keeping in mind that a bed is not a bed. The most sought-after services are residential treatment and group homes that are capable of managing aggression and severe dysregulation. These two services account for 65% of all the needed referrals and are some of the most difficult to access. As remarkable as this is, it's important to put it into perspective. Thousands of Minnesota youth do indeed get the mental health care they need, yet thousands more struggle in silence. Hundreds languish on wait lists, and for our most complex youth, those adversely impacted by the social determinants of health, who are in county custody, who have complex comorbid health conditions, they board, they wait, and they suffer. While mental health providers are able to meet some of their needs, they take on tremendous liability and financial risk when they accept these outlier cases. The development of the hub was funded by a HERISA grant awarded by the Department of Health, and it is free to our communities. Our weekly Getting to Yes calls have become a one-of-a-kind venue for impassioned thought leadership.
I'm sorry, we'll have to get you to wrap up here so we have time for everybody else.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Next, I have Mr. James Stewart. I do have my assistant with a timer here. When you hear that goes off, that'll be the two-minute mark. So thank you for taking the time to be here today. Sorry we're having to put a time limit on because this is some very great information, and we really are appreciative of everyone taking the time to be here. If you'd like to please introduce yourself and begin your testimony, please.
Sure. I'm James Stewart. I'm the CEO of Grafton Integrated Health Network. Good afternoon, Honored Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'd like to thank you for this opportunity to address you today. Grafton is a new residential provider to the state, but we're not new to Minnesota as our crisis intervention system, UCURU, has been being used by about 40 entities here in Minnesota, including 21 public school districts and 6 education cooperatives. I've been asked to address both the national Minnesota marketplace from Grafton's perspective. Nationally, I gained my perspective as the CEO of Grafton, currently serving children from 8 states, and as the immediate past president of MHCA, a national behavioral health group of over 165 community behavioral health entities in 34 states. From that perspective, it's easy to see that the full continuum of care in the behavioral health industry is incomplete at best. Post-COVID, behavioral health demand has doubled, and this is particularly true for high acuity children. The community behavioral health continuum was ill-prepared for this expanded demand. The numbers have overwhelmed an already underfunded and understaffed system in every state. Licensed professional staffing, including nursing, is a major challenge everywhere. It's even more pronounced for children with special needs. For residential providers, professional staffing is not the only issue. As you have mentioned here today, paraprofessional staffing, known as direct service professionals, is an even larger barrier to allowing us to serve more children in the beds available. To be fully staffed for 30 beds at our Cold Spring facility, we would need to have approximately 50 DSPs under Maryland regulations. God almighty, Minnesota regulations. After 2 years, we've only been able to hire 24. Minnesota's to be commended for recognizing the gap in developing its PRT benefit. I can say particularly the Department for Human Services was a great partnership with Grafton bringing us up here. From a demand standpoint, since we started our services in June 22, the demand is probably greater than we expected. We'd be happy to discuss some issues. Ones I want to point out, human capital, high acuity IDD children, and dual documentation for children 18 and over is a real problem. And one last thing I'll point out is I do think there's a continuum of group home model for the more high acute children that you can utilize an EPSDT Medicaid benefit to help pay for that would be very beneficial in Minnesota. I'm sorry I rushed through that.
No, thank you. Appreciate that. Next I have Matthew Bauer. Welcome to the committee. Thanks for taking the time to be here. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Matt Bauer. I am the Deputy Director of Juvenile Facilities for Dakota County Community Corrections. I'm here today representing the Minnesota Juvenile Detention Association, MNJDA. MNJDA provides both detention and juvenile justice treatment programs throughout Minnesota. Our juvenile justice treatment programs are referred to as BRASS 185 facilities in the DHS report on children in out-of-state residential placements. They are similar to children's group residential care, but licensed by the Minnesota Department of Corrections. MNJDA is boarding and serving mentally ill children statewide due to a lack of capacity in the residential mental health continuum. Boarding and detention can yield adverse effects for children. Despite our efforts, many youth do not receive the level of mental health care they qualify for. As outlined in the Youth Interventions Report, recommendations include supporting children with mental illness to be in appropriate treatment settings and creating opportunities for collaborative continuum creation with correctional treatment and detention programs. In the immediate term, children with mental illness require greater support while in our facilities. The reality of Minnesota's continuum of care is that many youth are having their mental health needs met in correctional facilities. And we need to invest in and in support these youth while we rebuild our continuum of care. The facilities within MNJDA face many of the same challenges as residential care facilities. Staff recruiting, hiring, retention are consistent challenges. Investing in treatment services for the increasing number of youths we see in mental health crisis is necessary. I'm proud of the staff and all of these facilities who work with the youth in Minnesota who have nowhere else to go. To many of these youth, the staff are the support they desperately need. We are invested in the youth's well-being and success. We need to advance real discussions about where the youth in Minnesota are having their needs met and invest in those settings while rebuilding a healthy continuum of care that effectively serves all youth. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Next, I have Mr. Joel Bakken. Thank you for taking time to be here today. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Mr. Chair, esteemed members of the committee, my name is Joel Bakken. I'm the Executive Director of Solutions Behavioral Healthcare Professionals, a nonprofit mental health center serving Greater Minnesota. I'm a licensed psychologist and a board certified behavior analyst. Today I want to speak about how Rule 245D limits the capacity of corporate foster care providers to serve children who have a history of behavior challenges or out-of-state placements. The intent of the rule is to prioritize person-centered practices and prohibit inappropriate interventions such as restraints. This is commendable and a necessary development to ensure the rights of individuals with disabilities are protected. However, Rule 245D includes many other prohibited procedures that have been inappropriately generalized to children, resulting in challenges in supporting these placements. The pendulum of Rule 245D at this regulation has swung too far. All kids need limits. All kids need structure. 245D does not allow for basic rules that would support child development. First, common sense parenting interventions are prohibited under this rule. This includes doing your homework before you play outside, or not allowing them to watch TV until midnight, or even bedtimes at all. Second, these regulations prohibit common sense safety measures, like preventing an agitated or aggressive child from going into another room or going outside to harm another child. The only option of this rule is to use positive supports. You've heard about that earlier. The positive support rule promoted by DHS to address behavioral concerns is not well defined and lacks a consistent philosophy of behavior change. The result of these regulations is that corporate foster care facilities cannot provide basic structure and limit setting to support a placement in their facility and effectively address mental health needs. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Next, I have Mel Winkler. Thank you for taking the time to be here. Please begin your testimony.
Thank you, Chair, members of the committee. I appreciate the opportunity to testify for this discussion and want to explain that I am Mel Winkler. I'm the Director of Quality Assurance at Northwood Children's Services up in Duluth. Our mission and vision is to offer a continuum of services for children and youth and families with mental health difficulties. We offer an array of services, including early childhood mental health daycare and treatment, elementary and middle school day treatment programs, and specialized day treatment for our kids on site with higher needs that can't be addressed in their own home school. Our four residential programs include a 35-day diagnostic program, a qualified residential treatment program, a PRTF, we're the first one, and corporate foster care programs or community residential settings that serves 20 kids at a time. We also offer outpatient skills and therapy for children who may or may not be involved in other programs in our continuum. We serve over 275 students a day and strive to provide the best care possible for kids and families from all over the state of Minnesota. Northwoods has worked diligently to create and incorporate many different levels of service within a site-based continuum. This affords us flexibility and accommodation for treatment and growth. We have the philosophy that it's important to take chances on kids who appear risky on paper and believe they can succeed with the right milieu and supports. We utilize this continuum in both directions for some of the most difficult and long-term students to support them until such time as they can be in some sort of family setting or become adults. One example of this would be one of our corporate residential setting students. She is bright, witty, and a social young lady and her wishes to be adopted by a family someday. This student has been served in multiple different places, including hospitals, residential treatment, foster care, and shelters since the age of 9 when her parents' rights were terminated. She acted out her feelings of loss and abandonment with self-harm, suicide attempts, and severe aggression towards others. It's important to note that at the age of 14, she's almost 6 feet tall and 300 pounds. She's a force of nature when she gets angry. So the continuum of services is very important, and we appreciate the time to talk about it. Thanks.
Thank you, and thank you for sharing that information. Next, I have Sufei Wong McCon. Thank you for taking the time to be here. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Fisher and members of this committee. My name is Sufei Wong McCon. I'm the SVP for Program Services at VOA Minnesota. VOA's four children's residential mental health programs are highly specialized, including one of the few programs locally treating children with co-occurring mental health and substance use disorder diagnoses, and the only lock-setting mental health program in Minnesota. And like the other 10 qualified residential treatment programs, provide care to Minnesota's children who are in severe mental health crisis. But VOA's children's residential treatment programs are on the brink of financial unsustainability. The loss of our 76 residential beds and a shrinking facility pool will be deeply felt. It will likely leave a significant gap in in-state care options for Minnesota's children. Reimbursement revenue has not kept up with the rising cost of operations. The existing fee-for-service model does not adequately account for the increased expense of employee training for job readiness that is required to treat children with complex mental health issues. The continued staffing crisis has prevented providers like us from reaching the full licensed residential capacity our programs can support. This conditions challenge the sustainability of all our children's residential treatment in Minnesota. The crisis of boarding children in hospitals and sending them out of state for care emphasizes the critical importance of maintaining our current capacity to serve children. The fiscal year has been challenging, yet we have persisted because we know our programs change lives. We know that with specialized interventions and proven treatment modalities, the children our care do get better, and they're one step closer to returning to live safely in their own homes and communities. Every child is a unique story, but what each of our residents has in common is that they want to feel more in control of their own lives, have healthy relationships, and add skills to their tool belt when they move on from our programs. And that's our job, to work hard to make sure that is their reality. I have a letter in my office from the mother of one of our former residents who successfully moved on from one of our programs a few years ago. Erin came to us with severe depression, suicidal ideation, and was withdrawn from family and friends. Her life tragically ended in an unrelated accident last year, but can I read this?
Yeah, go ahead.
But at her funeral, her mother requested that donations to our program go to our program in honor of the life-changing experiences she had with us. This is what her mom said. You gave her the tools to cope with and manage her demons. You helped her through adolescence. Unfortunately, there's such a need and demand for your program. I hope this donation and the program can be sustained to help many more people who suffer from mental illness and trauma. Thank you.
Thank you, and thank you for sharing that. And I'd like to thank all our testifiers who came before us today. Is there anyone else who would like to testify who is not on the list? Not seeing any. We've covered a lot of ground today. We know that this is a serious problem. I think the report that we had come in helps identify some of the issues. We know that we've got a lot more work that we still have to do. Some of it can happen this year, but more is going to have to happen next year. And this is to help set the table to start getting things ready also for next year. As I mentioned, we're not going to be able to solve it all at this point in time.
But this allows us to have the discussions continue going throughout the summer and into next fall so that we can come back to next year with a more robust set of answers to help address the issues we have out there. With that, we are at the end of our time, and I don't say anything else. This is our final meeting, so this last set of minutes, yes, I know. So our last set of minutes will be sent out by Mr. Kroos here for you all to sign. And with that, we are adjourned.